welcome to the Soccer Coaching Podcast, brought to you in association with our friends at Soccer Coach Weekly, reflecting our shared ambition to help coaches have the most effective, enjoyable and successful coaching journey for them and their players. We hope you enjoyed this episode and thanks for listening. Dan, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Scott, I'm really well, mate. Thank you so much for the invite. Honoured and delighted to be speaking with you.
I'm always grateful for any guests to give up their time to come on the podcast, but especially for you, Dan, because I am an avid listener to your podcast, and it's a privilege to be able to turn the tables, but also I feel in the pressure. I've got to be honest with you. You're such a pro, and I'm such an amateur, but I'm going to have my best shot at turning the tables on you and getting your views on things. So, and I know how busy you are, so thanks so much for giving up your time for this.
No, you're more than welcome. And I always say about my podcast, it's an excellent podcast, really only because I have outstanding guests. I'm a stunningly average host myself, but I love my guests. So that's what makes it, right?
Well, 100%. Well, I think, you know, what I try and copy from what you do is it's about listening and asking the right questions, isn't it? It's not always easy when you're hosting, but you're very, very good at listening and asking the questions that I'm sitting thinking, ask the guest that and you ask it. And it's that's always a sign of a great host. So, but Dan, we'll talk about that, I'm sure, and some other bits and pieces as well. I reached out to you because I was reading it back through your Soccer Tough book again for the second time. And I think when I read it the first time, I loved it and so much was relevant to me, but I was probably at the start of my coaching journey and it was almost like there was too much going on in my head where I was picking up bits. And going back the second time, it's really amazed me how much I'm getting more out of it the second time around because I can put it in the right place now. I got loads of that the first time, but I wasn't necessarily going to use it all. And now it feel like I understand it better from a bit more experience of being out on the grass and doing stuff. But also what it enabled me to do is trigger lots of questions that I've got. So I was like, Dan, let's go in the podcast. Please let me ask you some stuff. And you were kind enough to really quickly say yes. So thank you so much for that. And I'm looking forward to chatting around that and some other things as well, if that's okay with you.
Let's do it. Thank you for reading my book. And I'm excited to speak about it.
Brilliant. All right, Dan. Well, look, obviously, I'm a big fan. For those that maybe haven't heard as much about you or not quite sure what it is you do, a bit about yourself, your background and what it is you currently do, if that's okay.
Sure. Dan Abrahams, sports psychologist. I formerly a professional golfer many, many moons ago. Failed miserably to make any money from golf. Perhaps a slight lack of talent didn't help, to be honest, Scott, but I would largely...
I can relate to that.
Right. I can largely reflect back and go, okay, yeah, there were things missing from that perspective, but the software was definitely missing. You know, I didn't know how to manage myself around the course, engage in self-control, build my confidence. I was certainly committed, that's for sure. I worked hard at the game, but I didn't know how to practice effectively. And there's so many mini psychological aspects that let me down. And so that led me really to where I am today. I mean, I left my golfing playing career behind because, to be quite frank, I needed my bank account to expand a little bit more than it was. So I went through the PGA qualification. So I became PGA qualified. So I started out as a golf coach after my playing career. But I always had a real interest in the psychological side of golf, of sport. In fact, if I was to go back a little bit more, I would say I was reading some sports psychology books in my teen years. I probably should have been out on the beers with the lads and chasing girls or whatever teens do. But no, I was reading sports psychology books. So whether how one thinks about that is up to them. But that's what I was doing. When I was coaching golf, I decided to take things further. I went back to university. I did a degree in psychology and then a master's degree in sports psychology and really came to a crossroads. Do I carry on with the golf, with the psychology as an aid to my golf coaching, or do I leave the coaching behind and become a sports psychologist? And so I did the latter because I wanted to work across sports and in different domains. And so for the last 18 years, I've been a fully qualified and registered sports psychologist here in the UK and work globally. And I've been really blessed to experience, I suppose, a snowball effect to my career. I've worked across sports, but I've always said that I've principally focused on golf and football. Golf because I know it like the back of my hand, obviously, because I played it. I was lead psychologist for England Golf 2013 to 16 and worked with a number of players globally, on the main two tours. I've worked in football heavily. I've worked with half a dozen Premier League clubs. I've worked with some of the best players in the world, some of the best coaches, Champions League players, World Cup players, both men's and women's side of the game. I've held, I think, half a dozen contracts in the Premier League and English Championship. I last season and this season am the consultant psychologist to Feyenoord, so I was blessed to get the opportunity to work with them and still do. And they won the Eredivisie championship last season. I was a stunningly small part of the process there, but it was an honor and delight to be a part of that process. And again, along my journey with football, I've written four books, three of them football, one golf. You've alluded to one already, Soccer Tough, Soccer Tough 2, Soccer Brain. And then in other sports, I was lead psychologist for England Rugby going into the last World Cup, working alongside Eddie Jones. I have worked in a number of Olympic sports and tennis and basketball and across sports, I suppose. Esports even, I do quite a bit in esports now. And I have, as you've mentioned, a podcast called The Sports Psych Show, which tends to invite on academic sports psychologists. And we tend to try to demystify their research for coaches and all those involved in sports. So in short, Scott, I get around and put myself out there a little bit, but I just love my work and I love sports psychology. And I think we need to all be more passionate about this area. So that's me.
Well, considering the number of years you've been doing it for now, you still have a burning passion. You're like, you know, the young kid in the sweet shop that's still like the first time they got in there. And that's what comes through, Dan, when you talk about it. You blatantly love it and you keep it interesting for us that kind of are trying to pick up some of the stuff that you obviously you know a lot more about. I'm intrigued to know, Dan, because obviously with your own golf background then and, you know, the fact that, you know, it went the way it went and then you got into golf coaching, did you implement kind of some of the psychological side in your coaching to your clients, if you like, back then? Because I would imagine that they've come to you for technical practice, right? They want to be able to hit a drive better or did a putt better. And if you start talking about actually, you know, a desire to compete or concentration and stuff, I don't know if that's something that would have gone down as well back then as it maybe would do now, or did you keep it traditional coaching, or did you bring some of your own kind of more modern approaches around the psychological side of things?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. I think the best way I can answer that is to give you some insight into how I might coach now. You know, if I, whether you could describe it as getting in a time machine and going back, or whether it's deciding tomorrow that I'm going to give up sports psychology and go back to golf coaching, I would strive to do it differently. You know, sometimes you've got to respect the resources and the infrastructure you've got around you, because it's not always easy to do it, perhaps in the style that I'm about to describe. But certainly if I was coaching at a golf course that, you know, had pretty good practice facilities and, you know, maybe even something like a 9-hole pitch and putt that you can take players out onto, I would do so much more on the golf course or set up situations on a golf course. And again, respecting, you can't always do this at golf clubs, but, you know, trying to put golfers in the environment they play in sooner if they are early sort of beginner golfers, if you like, or early career golfers, for want of a better term. Getting them out there and hitting some shots on the course. And also for those more seasoned golfers who would come and see me, again, what I would probably try to persuade them towards would be an on-course session where we go out, we play some holes. You know, I just walk and accompany that player and we have a conversation. And we start to draw up a plan around their game in a more holistic fashion. So I can watch them and I say, has this person got a routine to their game? How are they reacting and responding to their shots? As well as looking at the shot patterns that they're experiencing, as well as looking at their golf swing and their entire game. You know, how are they chipping? How are they putting? You know, what does this look like? What is their general approach? I would take that more holistic viewpoint and that more contextual lens of their game on the golf course, because I think that snapshot is vital. And you use this word traditional. It's not a word I love, but you are quite right to point out that that traditional form of coaching is you work at a range, driving range, or you work on at the club, and they just go straight to the practice ground, and you get them to start hitting some 7-irons, and that's how you coach them from there. I'm not suggesting that that wouldn't or couldn't exist in what I was doing, but by and large, I would try to be a little bit more dynamic about it. And certainly with some golfers who are ambitious for their game, you know, we go out, we play, and we have a cup of tea in the clubhouse, and we just talk things through, and maybe we set some objectives around their game, and we talk a bit more broadly about the game in and of itself. You know, you've got to get the strategical viewpoint, the mental viewpoint alongside the technical and the physical viewpoint as well. So, yeah, I think I would just be a bit more dynamic in my approach. And I think that would also lend itself to it being a bit more enjoyable rather than just standing on a range all day long. Freezing cold as it tends to be in England. I remember wearing 12 or 13 layers at one point, standing there on a range, which thoroughly put me off. So, that's kind of how I would go about it. So it's just what my training has done. I take a very broad definition of sports psychology. You know, you've said you've listened to my podcast, and I say this all the time that, yeah, look, I'm into performance psychology, those classic C's of concentration, confidence, commitment, control, you know, team sports, collaboration, cohesion, communication, and so on and so forth. And obviously, as a sports psychologist, I'm heavily invested in welfare, well-being, and then mental health of players, but also, you know, sports psychology lends itself towards skill acquisition. You know, it lends itself towards learning and teaching. So all these pockets of areas, you know, psychology very much provides information and tools and techniques for these areas, and frameworks and constructs and concepts. So I take that broad definition. So I'd be much more robust and dynamic in terms of how I would teach now.
I've got a couple of quotes here from your book, if that's okay. And it just literally, this is, I could open up any page here and bring out a few things, but just to spark the conversation for this episode, one of the things you put in here, it says, "What is physical work without desire? Technical skill without concentration, tactical skill without confidence." And to me, it sums it up so perfectly, the fact that, you know, I could be obsessed with trying to help my players get physically stronger and technically better and more tactical aware, but if I'm ignoring the desire and the concentration, the confidence side, then I can only go so far. So my challenge as a coach is, can I be able to do both things? Can I work on the key aspects as well as the psychological side? And if it's okay, Dan, that's kind of what I want to talk about today with you, if that's right, and get some help around that.
Yeah.
Okay, so my first question would be, I've kind of been thinking about this, attitude and behavior. I think if we want to support our players around their attitude and behavior, are they the same thing or are they different?
Oh, attitude and behavior. That's a really good question. I would say that attitude is a behavior or a set of behaviors, an overt set of behaviors. So I would say they are similar, related. I think, you know what, I very rarely come on podcasts and get stumbled by a question. You've kind of stumbled because I'm trying to think of all of the the psychological theories. There's a guy called Chad Schfell who's done all the work around attitude in psychology, and I'm trying to draw on my memory of what he would say there. But I think attitude is a collection of behaviours that others are overtly seeing from you. You know, as you know, if we're going to talk about football here, then it's within a session or in and around the in and around the training ground, or however you want to describe it. So I know that both are important.
Absolutely. Okay, fantastic. That helps. So my follow-up question would be, can coaches then build in and coach behaviors, therefore kind of to drive, you know, what they might deem as a positive attitude. Is it possible for us to embed kind of good practices within our training sessions and our match day approach and everything else that we do to really support behaviors that support development?
The answer is yes. I mean, I think let's just go back a step, and maybe I should have responded to your first point around or your quote out of my book. And that's to say that, and I would probably want everybody listening in right now to use their imagination and draw this in their mind as I'm speaking. If we think of technical, tactical, and physical being at the heart of sport in many respects, every single sport one can think of technical, tactical, physical lies at the heart. I would argue that the psychology or the psychosocial, or even deeper, the biopsychosocial, when I say biopsychosocial, bio is body, psycho is mind, social is world, body, mind, world, body, mind, world. So I suppose I'm asking people to consider the people in their program, their players, as consisting of body, mind, world. Minds in bodies in worlds, if you like. That's basically what your players are, minds in bodies in worlds. And so what I always say is that whilst technical, tactical, physical lies at the heart of your sport, and we're talking about football here today, lies at the heart of football, lies at the heart of soccer, undoubtedly biopsychosocial or psychology, if we're going to simplify it, is ever-present. Ever-present, always influencing technical, tactical, physical. As I've kind of mentioned there in that quote that you've lifted from my book, it's always there. So confidence is always there, concentration is always there, self-control is always there, or lack thereof. Attitude, I suppose, as you've mentioned it, is always there. A whole bunch of characteristic behaviors are always there. And that's essentially biopsychosocial. So it's non-stop. And so I'm answering your question in this way because I think that you've got to draw upon this idea, you've got to draw upon this model and say that, okay, psychology is happening all the time. And myself as a coach, I can instrumentally, purposefully, deliberately work on the biopsychosocial or the psychology of the player at all times. You know, I can do the things that are through my coaching behaviors, through my voice, through my instructions, through my feedback, through my body language, when I intervene, when I hold back, am I asking questions, am I silent, and so on and so forth, right? All those kind of things. I can engage in those things to deliberately influence the psychology of my players, my people, which is impacting technical, tactical, physical. Am I engaging them technically, tactically, physically? Am I helping them learn technically, tactically, physically? Am I improving their capacity, their ability to perform or compete technically, tactically, physically? So it's always happening. So the short answer to your question is absolutely, of course. And this is something that I've become increasingly interested in, is how can coaches incorporate as many processes within their coaching practice on the grass that influences player psychology, which ultimately then influences the technical, tactical, physical sides of the game. And that's why I can tend to, and I say this with the greatest of respect, regale a little bit at the notion of the sort of the corners, if you like. Well, in this session, I've got to cover the technical corner, or the tactical corner, or the psychological, or the social corner. And I understand, and I mean this with respect, because I know some very great people, for example, laid down the four-corner model. If we're going to talk about the FA model, there's some brilliant, brilliant people who developed that and deliver on that. And I understand why that is a useful way to help all coaches see their session design through the prism of that holistic process. But I do wonder sometimes if we segment it, and I read this a lot on social media. Somebody says, "Oh, I've got to cover the psychology corner there." And again, if I may say so, it's too simplistic a lens of things there. That we really, really want to see this from the lens of this is always happening, and I can do the things through my session design and through my coaching behaviors that is going to constantly influence player psychology, hopefully for the better. But I also have to bear in mind my coach behaviors and my coach practice, what is negatively impacting the player psychology as individuals and as teammates. So a bit of a long-winded answer and rant there, but the answer is yes, you can.
Well, and on the four corner model, then it's funny you mention that, because I always had this kind of way of looking at it where I see the four corners, and I totally get why the FA put it in there. I totally get it makes sense for us to make sure we've got these things in it, like in our planning. But I always felt like you needed the four corners. They need a circle kind of going in the middle across all the four corners. And that's your psychological bit. It's right bang in the middle. It almost draws it all together, where you've got your technical, tactical, physical, maybe social, but the psych is like a circle that goes across all, you know, it sits across all four, because like you, I don't know how you ignore it. And like you said yourself, I remember doing practices a few years back now when I was doing my FA badges, and, you know, you literally have a list of words you just drop into the psych sides because you didn't really know what you're doing with it. You put them in there, just the confidence are going there, or resilience or something, you put me just so you were ticking a box. But how much you actually did that in practice, you know, was really hit or miss, where actually if you embed it across all four of the corners, I think it has more relevance.
Yeah, I think it's a visually more striking image. I mean, my poorly titled biopsychosocial model of coaching. I say poorly because it's not it's difficult to catch. But, you know, I don't put it in the middle, but I just put it underneath, and I put arrows in between the technical, tactical, physical, and that biopsychosocial. So yeah, it's constantly interacting. It's constantly there, you know, and everybody listening in can, you know, can think about that young player who, you know, maybe consistently turns up a little bit late for training, and there can be, as we're all human beings and we can instantly judge that. But let's think about the biopsychosocial element of this, the socio environmental landscape they're coming from, you know, in as much as maybe they've got some things that they've got to do, or they're prohibited on travel, logistics, etc., etc. And so the social is playing a big part there. The young player who struggles to manage themselves through mistakes, you know, perhaps is demonstrating times where they lack a little bit of resilience, or they fail to demonstrate resilience. Well, okay, well, maybe they haven't been shown or taught anything in their lives that has helped them build the capacity to be resilient in those kind of moments. There are so many mini examples we can throw at this, whereby the biopsychosocial is impinging on the technical, tactical, and physical from really three areas. As I said, I actually use three P's: participation, progression, performance. But that participation piece is the engagement piece. The progression piece is the learning piece, and the performance piece is the competitiveness. Because I would always argue that no matter who you are on planet Earth as a coach, by and large, we're engaged in those three P's: participation, progression, performance. Now, you can say an under six, under seven, under eight coach, they have to consider the biopsychosocial, certainly from a participation position, because they need to engage 6, 7, 8-year-olds. That's going to be the number one task. But you would also argue that Jurgen Klopp and Emma Hayes have to do that.
Absolutely.
Because if they don't, then it's the old, that manager's lost the change room, and that's the end of that. And that happens often behind the scenes at the adult elite level, the professional level. So the participation piece might be the dullest of pieces, when it comes to coaching, but it is, you would argue, the number one. And then you've got the progression piece, which is, how do I help players to learn? How do I help them to learn the game, the logic of the game? How do I help them, you know, to learn the language, the cognitive side, and as I say, the technical, tactical, physical side? How do I help them to learn the game? And then the final P is the performance, which is the competing part. How do I help them be better performers in this game? So, you know, biopsychosocial is constantly happening. It's constantly interacting, as you've mentioned now. And I love your idea of having it in the circle in the middle of all of those edges. And it's constantly interacting with technical, tactical, physical, constantly working in servitude to participation, progression, performance, engagement, learning, and competing.
Brilliant, Dan. A lot of the listeners that listen to the podcast will be grassroots football coaches, a lot of volunteer parents like myself that just go out there and trying to do the best we can and muddling through. And I could be wrong here, but I'd be interested to know your view on this. I still get a sense that the psychological side of the training and our approach to kind of supporting the players is an extra bit. It's the add-on bit. It's the bit we kind of think about, you know, if we need to. It isn't kind of necessarily entwined into kind of, you know, as important as maybe, you know, playing out from the back or where our cones might go or ball striking or something. It's the extra bit. And I wondered if you think that's a view that you've experienced and where you see soccer and football, or if it's just where I am. And if so, are we getting it wrong? Should it be more involved and more embedded in it? Because it can make a bigger difference than we probably give it credit for.
Yeah, and I think there's several things to say to begin with there, which is, number one, I completely respect and understand the vast majority of coaches are volunteer coaches and they do a wonderful job. They really, really do. Coaching is hard, it's tough, or something I say in one of my other books, Soccer Brain, is I open it by saying that I believe coaching is one of the toughest hobbies or professions that you can actually choose. Why? Because you're dealing with human beings, and human beings have different needs, wants, hopes, doubts, beliefs, expectations, values, cultural experiences, personalities, and so on and so forth. It's also tough because every sport, really, in many respects, and I know people love to come on and say, oh, soccer or football, that's simple. It's a simple game. Well, you can simplify any sport. Yeah. You know, you can say golf is just about hitting the ball from point A to point B, but actually all sports are complicated. By that, I mean, they are hard. You know, of course they're hard. Football is hard. You've got an opposition trying to beat you. You know, you've got a range of interpersonal and intrapersonal skills that you've got to demonstrate in a game that works in seconds. You've got to make stunningly quick decisions, be aware of what's going on around you, anticipate quickly, and so on and so forth. So it's a hard game. So I'm saying that because I think that people by and large do a great job within their coaching with relation to how difficult coaching can be and how complex human beings are. And I respect that. So anything I say on this podcast and any others, when I go off on the scientific side of things, I respect how much time people have and don't have. I think your question speaks to a lot of what we've spoken about already. And you gave two interesting examples there. You said, oh, well, do too many people just see it as playing out from the back and, you know, laying down the cones? I immediately heard psychology there. You know, it's because I immediately, okay, well, how do I help my players engage in these activities around playing out from the back? How do I help my players learn how to play out from the back? What are my coach behaviors going to be? If I'm laying down the right activities, you know, am I trying to help them learn implicitly? Am I going to be very explicit here? Am I going to be command style in what I'm doing? Or am I going to lay down an activity where I'm helping them experience the activity and then I'm going to ask them questions afterwards? And so it's very much an autonomy supportive environment of learning. There's so many mini things here around learning. And then how am I going to help them compete when they play at the back? Because if they start playing out the back in the game, they might start getting a little bit nervous about doing that. And then maybe that's the old, oh, just get rid of it, kick it long, starts to come into their head because they don't want to look foolish. They don't want to make a mistake. A game of football often comprises a great deal of social anxiety. And coaches will say a lot about, well, I give my players permission to make mistakes, but then I say to them, well, do your players give themselves permission to make mistakes? Because those two aren't necessarily the same things. And so when you say about playing out the back, I'm thinking psychology, 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 biopsychosocial. When you talk about laying down cones, I also think about the psychology of the coach. I think of that the conscientiousness of the coach, because I've been blessed to work 18 years, well, not quite 18 years when I think of the Premier League, but certainly over a decade, standing behind some pretty good Premier League pitches in training and watching some pretty high profile people lay down some pretty wonky pitches. Yes. So, you know, and one of the things Jose Mourinho was famed for when he came to the Premier League from Porto to Chelsea was the tough nature of his interactions with his coaches. And when I was at AFC Bournemouth for a few years, Eddie Howe was very much like that with his coaching staff. Tough on their coaching staff to be high conscientious, to put the cones out correctly. Cones being a bit of a metaphor here for, you know, being very precise in what they're doing. So again, when you say cones, I think psychology, psychology, psychology. I dare you to, challenge is a better word. I challenge you to find something in the game that doesn't involve psychology. And that's the thing. That's the best way I can answer this. It is always happening. And when people look at the world through that lens, all of us, and my argument is that while some people might say to me, oh, damn, that's such a burden, what a nightmare. Actually, I think when you look at the world that way, when you look at coaching through that lens, okay, there is a certain burden then suddenly on you. You've got to do a little bit more thinking around this. But actually, then you start to see influence. I can influence things here. I can influence my players, my team in a much greater way when I see that everything is enveloped in psychology, the psychosocial or the biopsychosocial areas.
Absolutely, Dan. I couldn't agree more. I think it comes on to my next question now then. Without giving you the six things that we have three what we call core values. That's respect, effort, fun. That's our core values. But then we have six behaviors that we believe are really important to help player development. Now, I guess my question to you, and please answer honestly and tell me if you think this is rubbish or not, or if we're doing things wrong. Are we right in highlighting the six key behaviors that we think and have agreed with the players? We've got under 12s, under 15s. So to give you some context, you know, they're still very young. Grassroots players, you know, good, but just grassroots players. We have six key behaviors and we actually run practices around these. So, you know, we'll run a practice to actually explicitly practice that as a behavior. It might be wrapped around a particular, you know, playing principle, but essentially we're looking at that. Please tell me whether you think that's an approach that makes sense, would work, or are we wrong to limit it to six? Should we be thinking more broadly? And it depends on, you know, more variables than that. What's your kind of views around that as an approach?
May I ask you what your six are?
Absolutely. Well, I was going to ask you what you think but I would tell you ours and you can tell me ones you think are rubbish and ones you think might be better. So we have our six behaviors. And again, these have been things that we spoke about. We had a session with the players. We talked about different things and we agreed on the six. So, and they're kind of in order, I guess, or that's a bit unfair, but they're in order. So number one, we've got desire to compete. So we want to have a good desire to compete. Number two, a desire to, or we call it a determination to improve. Number three is resilience. Then we have teamwork. Then we have confidence and we have responsibility, which was ownership, but we've changed it. So the idea being that we felt like if there's a million and one things you can be good at, but actually if you've got these six key behaviors, we call them, then that's really going to help us then drive on in the sessions to work on the football side of things we want to do. So whatever the football things is we do, you know, as long as we've got those six things wrapped around it, you know, you're probably going to be good. And we do say to the players, look, we'll create the environment to support these, but essentially they're kind of on you to bring in. We'll work and we'll encourage it and we'll support. We won't destroy any of these, but actually we really need you to bring these as much as you can. And then it helps really focus on the football. The idea being, if we've got the three core values that are there, plus the behaviors in good place, then it gives us more opportunity, like you were saying, there, to focus on just doing the football activities and apply ourselves to that stuff whilst embedding these along the way. But please, so, I'm open to your thoughts on this one.
So, I'm going to give you my thoughts by asking you another question. You've given me the what, and you've given me the, by and large, you've given me the why, although I'm sure we can talk all day about the whys and why these are important. You've given me the what, the six behaviors. Could you enlighten me a little bit on the how? And I know there will be multiple hows here, but perhaps you can hone in on one and give me a how you might do that in a session.
Absolutely. So, we work in 6 week blocks, generally speaking, like half term. So our first week will be a games week where we'll just maybe pick two or three of the behaviors, maybe just one or two. So we might say desire to compete and resilience, and we'll play games. And we'll do like a silly resilience game for under 12s would be every time you score a goal, you roll the dice and that's what the goal is worth. because you'll get someone that will score a goal and they'll roll a six. They're delighted. Another player will score three goals and roll three ones. It happens all the time. It's mad. So I know it's a simple, fun way, and they'll get frustrated at first, but actually, you know, they can lose the game 6-3. They always those roll a dice. So it's a bit of fun, but actually it's talking about a bit of resilience. We might play a game where actually we deliberately give bad decisions. So as we're reffing the games and we'll give free kicks, we'll give fouls the wrong way, we'll give things. And it's maybe that's more for the older players, but we do that as well. And we talk about the resilience and dealing with kind of things that don't go your way and that stuff. So we will do explicit games in which we can get the players to kind of be challenged to demonstrate or work on that particular key behavior.
I love your dice game. And you know, the really interesting landscape, before I come on to answer your question properly, the really interesting landscape is actually I can think of Premier League clubs who would do well to do the kind of things you've just spoken to there, and probably wouldn't necessarily do so because they are Premier League clubs, because they've got Premier League players worth 50 million in transfer fees. But the reality is that the kind of behaviours you're talking about are essentially skills. They're competencies, they're skills that can be improved upon. And most of these players need to continue to improve upon these skills. And so your dice game, as an example, but everything you've spoken to there would be useful in these environments. And so the reason why I wanted you to share those behaviors and the reason why I asked you that question is because there is no wrong and no right, because you've asked me to provide a value judgment. There's no wrong and right in coaching other than, and I want to emphasize this, bullying and any kind of ism, sexism, racism, etc., etc. Those are the only things that could be, important to highlight those things and get rid of those across the game, across any sport, across life. But those are the only things that are wrong. Otherwise, it's not so much what's right and what's wrong. It's about decision-making. Coaching is about judgment and decision-making. And really that, in very simple terms, because it's probably more complicated and broader, deeper, but who, what, how and why, in essence? Who are we coaching? What do we want to coach them? Why do we want to coach them these things? How do we want to coach them these things? And then probably, why do we want to coach them these things in the manner that we're talking about there? And constantly asking ourselves those kind of questions. Those are useful questions. Who, what, how, why, that can guide our judgment and decision-making as coaches, because that's what coaching is. Again, come back to, there's no right and wrong. And that, what we've done there is a process I might do with somebody like Arne Slot at Feyenoord. If I sat down with Pep, I would do precisely the same. He's forgotten more about football than I'll ever know. But as a psychological coach, I've got frameworks to guide his decision-making. I can't tell him what to do. I can possibly in some psychological domains, or I can help him lean heavily in certain directions, but I can pose the questions that help him and his coaching staff have more sophisticated conversations around their judgment and decision-making. So it's, to emphasize this, great, you've got those behaviors and you've articulately explained why those are important and how you're going to, fantastic. Now, me as a bit of a psychological agitator, I could come along and go, well, the challenge of laying down behaviors is that every single behavior, every single characteristic, personality characteristic, both helps and hinders. So we can think of a word like commitment, for example, and I certainly want players to be really, really committed, but then sometimes players are too committed to a certain course and I want them to be able to flex away from commitment. Maybe I want them to relax a little bit. I can think of responsibility, and I think it's really important, for example, that players take responsibility. But they can't take responsibility all the time. and it's not a great environment if it's only about the players taking responsibility. So I'm looking at this in a slightly more nuanced and complex manner, and I'm being a slight agitator. But by and large, I would orient towards, you know what, Scott, sounds great to me. And I think you're way ahead of the curve by having these six in your environment. And then it's just about that. Then it's really emphasizing how, what multiple ways can we deliver on this? Yeah. And making sure that you and your coaches are engaging in session design and coach behaviors that align themselves in as best as possible to these six behaviors. And looking at their getting in the weeds and looking at the microscopic ways to influence player behavior around these six behaviors. I think it's great. I think it's fantastic. It's just then the ongoing conversation is continuing to look at how do we get better and better and better at delivering on this. Simple as that.
Brilliant, Dan. Well, I'll take that as positive feedback. So thank you so much. You make a good point about, you know, the fact that actually you can almost overramp these things as well, can't you? It's all right, make it shining a light on it, but some players, they can get obsessed with certain things and you've got to dial down sometimes as well. And I think it's a good point you make around that one. Is there anything there that you would say, look, actually, if I was approaching like, you know, an under 12s football team, you know, I would certainly have maybe this as one of the key behaviours or this as a key behaviour, or is it very much dependent on the group that you've got, Dan?
Yeah, I think it's dependent on the group you've got and the context you find yourself in and the philosophy you want to deliver on. You know, if you look here, you've got determined to improve. Well, that immediately makes me think you're not necessarily... Let me start again on that one. I would ask questions around what kind of club you have, what experiences you want players to have, because there are very many 12-year-olds, 11-year-olds who play for the love of the game and just simply want to turn up and play, and maybe don't necessarily have a huge determination to improve, and that's not part of their lens of their world. And that's absolutely fine. And it's absolutely fine as well to have a club and a team where that's really, really important. So then it's about handling that. Who are your participants and who do you want your participants to be? Because being determined to improve suggests that it's not just about participation. It's about, you know, taking soccer seriously. So I think that's an interesting juxtaposition there. I think that, you know, even like with 12-year-olds, the desire to compete, you know, obviously that landscape is horribly complex around when do you start teaching players to compete. And I could be obsequious about this and sort of say, well, you start to learn to compete when you start playing at 6 and 7 years old by learning basic skills. You know, you learn basic skills in the game, then you become a better competitor in the future, arguably. Again, I'm being a bit of an agitator there, but I think the point you're making is the desire to compete is the capacity to self-control out there on the pitch, to deal with negative internal signatures like thoughts, emotions, feelings, and be able to do things on the pitch like stick to roles and responsibilities, challenge hard, etc., etc. Okay. Do we want that in our, do we need to do that at 12 years old? That's the kind of conversations that might happen. And plus also we need to be very, very careful about the desire to compete, because actually motivation to compete in and of itself is actually quite complex and multidimensional. You know, I can draw on many case studies that I've worked on in, let's say, the Premier League at that adult elite professional level, whereby actually helping players align with their love of teamwork and their love of moving and simply their love of playing has helped them look more motivated and more committed on the pitch, but doesn't necessarily align with their managers or their head coaches want for them to win the game and be player of the match and score a hat trick and keep a clean sheet. Actually, there's many, many people who are much more motivated by that classic sort of intrinsic motivators rather than the extrinsic notion of win, score, et cetera, be, you know, aligned with rewards and punishments there. So again, there's a nuance there that, you know, getting in the weeds, that's the kind of questions that somebody starts to ask when you've got behaviours such as desire to compete at the 12-year-old level. So it's an interesting landscape, and you can have some really interesting conversations. Again, no right and wrong, but it is recognizing that human beings are complex. And so subsequently, there's not really one way to, for example, compete. And there might not be, that determination to improve might both help and hinder your landscape, your culture, if you like, and so on and so forth.
So it's one of the key things here, Dan, to make sure that, I guess, we define what these terms mean with our players. So we're on the same page. When we talk about one of these behaviors, we actually can all see it for what it is. So there's no misunderstanding there. So when we talk about a desire to compete as a team, we can talk about, okay, what is it like in practice? What does it actually mean for us and our group of players? You know, so we're all kind of saying the same thing. So there's no confusion about, you know, that, you know, it's going to go one way or the other. Is that one of the benefits of maybe doing this, is you get that clarity in the definition of the terms we're using?
One of the benefits of doing this is that you can have better conversations with your colleagues, and you can potentially have better conversations with players. I think whenever you've got frameworks in place, I'm hot on frameworks for this precise reason, because it promotes broader, deeper, more sophisticated conversations. As I say, whether it's between yourself and your fellow coaches, or between yourself and your players, or the parents of those players. What I would say to you is, you can go really broadly in one of two directions here, is that if you're looking at definitions, if you're looking at putting more meat on the bone around these behaviors, you and your coaches can further define these, or you can go out to your players and get them to define them. Or in addition to that, you can simply leave it open and get individual players to define it for themselves.
Obviously,
again, that's entirely up to you. You would argue the third choice there is the most robust choice.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because what you're doing in your coaching culture is you're laying down the framework. I mean, this is what I would tend to do. You lay down the framework, and then you facilitate a process whereby each individual defines it for themselves. In that way, you're guiding, you're putting up borders and boundaries, and you're putting guides and steering posts, rules even, although I hesitate to say rules, but you're putting up these guidelines and borders and boundaries, so not just anything goes. Yet at the same time, you're accommodating for individual differences. Can you see that? Can you see that? So you're you know, and so I've got this at the moment with a women's team I'm working with, that, you know, we've got three words. I tend to love action-based words, and we've got three words: intensity, patience, and togetherness. So again, in line with what you said earlier, you can have a million and one words, but we've drawn down on these three things, and the players chosen themselves, although again, I gave them a list of about 20 words, action-based words, adjectives essentially, and they chose intensity, patience, and togetherness. And then we got the players to come up with some behaviors related to those words. And they picked three each just to keep things uniform. But then what we're now doing, and I've had the coaching staff, it's a reasonably resourced, it's a professional club, so it's a reasonably resourced club. Now the coaching staff are digging in with each individual. What does this mean to you? What does intensity mean to you? What does togetherness mean to you? What does patience mean to you? What am I going to be seeing from you? You know, we've got these three words, action words. We've got three behaviors for each action word, and we're collectively aligning ourselves with these. But then with each individual, well, how can we onboard you there? What do we need to get help you improve there? What do we need to be aware of from you in terms of what this means to you? Because togetherness can mean one thing to one player and something different to another player. And togetherness also then holds a strength of one player and a weakness of another player, and so on and so forth. So you've got to have those nuanced conversations, at least at the very highest level. And not enough clubs do this at the very highest level. And so this is where often the cultural gap happens, the schisms happen, and that's where things fail with relationships and with performances. So yeah, I think this stuff is really, really important and pertinent.
And Dan, from your own experiences of things you may be seeing, you know, in your world of work, And you've mentioned a few things already, things like, you know, coaching behaviors and questioning interventions. Is there any kind of tips or you know, any kind of things you've seen that you think actually, you know, if you want to embed some of this psychological side into your practices, here's some ways you might want to go about it as a coach?
Yeah, look, you know what? Firstly, I'm going to reflect back what you've done, which is make a decision about how you want to do this and have an overarching principle. So for instance, you at your club have decided to go down the path of these behaviors, and then everything leans towards that. And I think that's a great way to do it. There are, of course, other ways. You know, in my, if I may, just leaning on my books for a second, I mean, I've always been passionate about demystifying this side for both players and coaches. And you said you were rereading Soccer Tough, and in Soccer Tough, I talk about squashing ants. I talk about having a match script. I think it's in Soccer Tough 2, I talk more about a game face, although one of the chapters very much aligns itself with the idea of game face in Soccer Tough. So I'm introducing these kind of tools and techniques that coaches can use. And I have my online academy, which tends to get utilized in more in American soccer than in British football. But my online academy supported 25 college programs for the last 5 years, from Division One to Division Three in the American college system in soccer. And I just introduced these terms in. So these coaches help players to have game faces. They help players to squash their ants, ants being an acronym for automatic negative thoughts. They help players build a match script, which are basically 2 to 3 attentional cues in the game that help drive a focus of attention. So I think another way to do it is to look at this from a mental skills perspective as well, and potentially inject those into your coaching practice. So whether it's behaviours, whether it's mental skills, you know, I've had a coach, you know, utilise the New Zealand rugby idea of red head and blue head, for example. And I don't love that, and I won't get on to why I don't love it, but I'm perhaps a little bit biased and not loving it, but I understand why somebody might like it and they use it successfully. So even just something like that could be useful to just inject into your coaching process within your practice. And what are you doing? You're doing a little bit more on the psych side of things. But even just looking at this from a coach behavioral perspective, you know, if you sit down, if you're at a club and you get the opportunity to sit down with your coaching colleagues and start to think about how our behaviors as coaches impacts the players, even just looking at it through that lens. And I have a tool, a technique I talk about called coach head, get your coach head on. Where what I do, and I'll take you through this briefly, I get coaches to sit down and think about themselves at their best. So I'll get them to tap into memory. Tell me about you at your best. I get them to tap into their imagination. Tell me about a dream coaching session. And then I get them to tap into the perception of who they feel they need to be out there and who they think their players, what they think their players love about them. So memory, imagination, perception. Best sessions, dream sessions, who they think they need to be and what their players love about them. And again, I'm going to use action-based words. I get coaches to strip things back into action-based words. So if I use that as a guideline and start to think, okay, well, energetic, focused, and upbeat. Imagine a coach comes away with those three action words, energetic, focused, and upbeat. And then I get them again. We're going to strip things back into behaviors. Well, what does energetic mean? You know, well, I've got to, I've got to keep the energy of the group alive at all times. I've got to keep my energy alive and any colleague that I've got working with me. What does focus look like? Well, I've got to make sure I'm observing my players closely. Are they executing the practice in the style that I'd like them to? Am I helping my players be focused? There's a whole range you can think of there. And then upbeat, you know, am I staying positive for my players? Have I got a smile on my face? You know, am I engaging in positive gestures? Have I got that magnetic charisma that I might want to have that my players love about me? So you can have a range of behaviors underpinning these three action words. And that essentially is your coach head. My coach head is energetic, upbeat and focused. Right, I'm going to stick to that. Here's my behaviors. Now, automatically, I might be thinking about myself there. I might be thinking about my psychology or my psychosocial, my biopsychosocial, but that's going to positively impact on my players. I focus on me to help the we. The me helps the we. So there's so many, many ways, whether it's the way you do it through the behaviors, whether it's the mental skills, and those two can go hand in hand, absolutely. Whether it's the coach behaviors, and again, all three of those can go hand in hand if you want to go across the whole gamut there. Those are the kind of things I would ask coaches to start thinking about it. And the last thing to say on that is it really just requires a bit of thought. 10 minutes a week, just start now. Even if it's something that you're not going to do in 2023, 2024, even if it's something you think, oh my God, I can't do this in 2025, fine, start now. Car journey, a train journey, anything, 10, 20 minutes a week, just start to think about it. Take a few notes, start to put pen to paper how you're going to incorporate this. And you know what? That it will make such a difference. 10 minutes a week. You know, what's that 520 minutes a year? My mathematics correct? I'm a better psychologist than I am mathematician. So that's what I would say.
No, I love that, Dan. I mean, I wonder how many times I walked away from a session and I've kind of felt like, oh, it didn't really work. And I obsessed straight away with kind of, was the game not right? Was this? But I probably don't often think, was it my energy? Was it my focus? Was it my upbeatness? I don't go to there first. I kind of go to never the players, but I always look at like the practice itself. And actually, if my checkpoint is really like, you know, was I energetic? Was I focused? Was I upbeat? Well, straight away, you think, well, actually, either I haven't got those things right, so I think it's been a bit flat, or actually, I've got those right, so maybe it is something else. But looking at those first, reflection on your own coaching is so important, right? So it's a great point. Dan, a couple of last couple of questions, if that's okay. I promise you I won't keep you too much longer, but this is intriguing and I'm fascinated about a few things. Any red flags, anything you say or things you may have seen or done yourself, anything actually as a coach, these are things you definitely want to try and avoid or be conscious of, mindful about, if you think about how you might embed some, you know, psychological support to yourself or your players in your coaching sessions, things you shouldn't do or things you might want to be conscious about trying to dodge?
What immediately comes to mind there as you were speaking, I've written down two words actually, repetition and experimentation. Repetition as in, too often, and I could a world famous coach who I've observed doing something, I just thought, oh no, what are you doing? And I'm happy to be very wrong, but
that makes us all feel better then, all us coaches out there when we hear something like that. We all think, hey, do you know what? If someone like that can get it wrong, like then we're allowed to get it wrong ourselves, right?
I think it was just very much a lack of repetition, in as much as I obviously, there can be too much repetition out there, which leads to dullness and fatigue, but and staleness. But this coach in question did something really good that I personally, and I'm talking about my lens of the world here, I really enjoyed what they did. I thought it was brilliant. And then they didn't repeat it, and it needed repetition. It needed repetition. I think people get a bit scared of repetition. And again, I'm not talking about block practice and all that. I'm not getting into skill acquisition here, but I am talking about, if you take your behaviors that you spoke about earlier and the way in which you try to build those behaviors in your players, don't be scared of repetition. Don't be scared in trying to get, repeating your language, but also trying to help players, repeating practices, try to help them engage in those behaviors and learn them. They do have to sift into, in my opinion, they have to sift into long-term memory. And if you just do it once and don't do it again, which is what happened with this coach, to me, that's a bit head scratchy. And again, respecting the time that coaches have and sometimes the lack of resources, the lack of time, I understand that can be an issue, but that's just something to consider. And then I wrote down experimentation is in, I suppose the other word there is bravery with that. Just being brave to experiment, give it a go. If you think an idea is pretty funky, well, just go with it and see. Somebody I admire once said, coaching is basically a mini experiment every day. Well, why not make it a mini experiment every day? Give it a go, see what happens. And then I think the third thing, because as I'm speaking there, I'm thinking of people experimenting, giving something a go. And I'm thinking about, you know, or when do, you know, the question might be, well, when do I repeat, Dan? Or when does this mini experiment become a successful experiment? And I think that getting feedback from your people, getting feedback from your players, you know, I don't think that's the be all and end all. But I do think getting feedback from players and asking them what they thought of that practice, that process, that you know, something that you did, what did they think? What was their experience? What worked for them? What could be even better next time? And I think that's very pertinent around the mental side of the game. So I think really three words: repetition, experimental stroke, bravery, and feedback. Those are three things to really engage in if you really want to develop the incorporation of the biopsychosocial side of the game.
Thank you so much. We've got one last question which we ask all our guests on the podcast, and that is,
this is going to be the hardest, you know?
It's going to be the hardest. I promise it'll be the hardest question. 100%.
I know,
yeah,
this is going to be tough.
You'll need a pause for this one, or maybe not. I don't know. Let's see. Actually, it's quite interesting to see how quick people answer the question in the first place, because it shows you how much it's in their head already. But I'll ask the question: if there was one thing you could change about the world of coaching, what would that be?
I told you it's going to be the hard one. I'm going to be a broken record. I'm going to be a bit boring. I think what I'm speaking to is just I don't know how to put this, because I think this arena is broad and dynamic and vast and deep. So it's something along the lines of just more people being passionate about the things that we're speaking to, and or probably more understanding around the psychological side of things, which I think what I'm trying to do is take some culpability there. You know, I think we as sports psychologists are culpable for this as well. You know, and very much we're entrenched. You know, you can think of the sports sciences and stuff like that. We're very entrenched in the academic world of trying to get academic papers out there. And I'm not so much, because I've never been in that world. I've always wanted to be a practitioner. But and there's wonderful research out there. And that's why I have my podcast, The Sports Psych Show, because I want to help academics get their stuff across, because not enough of their great work sees the light of day when it needs to. And I understand why academics need to write in the way that they do and write the papers that they do, because ultimately it's their career, and that's how they're rewarded, with brilliant papers that have to be written in a certain way. But ultimately then the great stuff doesn't see the light of day with grassroots coaches, with all coaches. And sometimes people pick up the popular books, and sometimes the popular books are very good, but they kind of have one message and it misses that very complex landscape and or complicated landscape and the complexity of what it is to be human. I'm thinking Bounce here by Matthew Syed type thing. Sorry, Matthew. But that type of thing where it's like, yeah, very well written, very yeah, okay, but it's a little bit more complicated than made out. So I think it's trying to, this is probably the longest anybody's ever answered your question. I think it's helping people have more resources around this, and so they can and more accessible resources, so they could be more passionate about delivering on this, because you really can deliver on this when you start to see things in the manner that I feel I have described in this past hour. And many people can listen to that and go, what a load of rubbish, Dan. Nobody understands what you're talking about there. Or they can go, yeah, okay, I can see that. And so I just want them, people, to understand, if I was to sum it up, you can do so much of this on the grass, not all of it, but a lot of it. And so subsequently, if you do have a bit of time to learn about it, align alongside your work, alongside your family duties, I know it's tough, but it can be so much more rewarding. So that, I think that kind of answers your question.
Absolutely, you did, Dan. And I can vouch, as someone that loves your books, loves the podcast, and the only reason I think I've managed to gain any kind of traction in this space and get my head around it is what you do, is you're like the filter. You take the stuff out there that I probably wouldn't find or be able to understand, and you present it in a way through your guests and through your books that enable someone like me to be able to take some of that stuff and try and put into practice. And I can say, you know, I think the biggest difference from the players I've worked with has come from focus on the psychological side than it has maybe on the technical tactical side. And that's thanks to the work that you've done in the books that I've read that you've written and stuff. So thank you so much for your time today, Dan. It's been an honor for me to be able to turn the tables on you. I hope you haven't mind. You still manage to ask lots of questions anyway, because that's what you do. But I hope you haven't mind having the tables turned.
Yeah, you've been awesome, mate. Really, really good, really great questions and thoughtful responses from yourself, which I think that's so important. It's a two-way conversation, isn't it? And thank you for sharing the behaviours that you. I think it sounds like you've got a wonderful culture there. So, yeah, no, I appreciate your time. And if anybody wants to find me and follow me, they can find me at danabrahams.com. That's my website where they can find my books and get in contact if they'd like to. I have a wealth of X formerly Twitter accounts, but do seek me out at danabraham77, showing my age there. And what people should know is I'm also on Instagram at Abraham's Sport, and Facebook at Abraham's Soccer, and LinkedIn and Facebook. I write a mini post every single day talking to the kind of things that we spoke about, so please do follow me there. And if you enjoyed those rambles, and you can follow the kind of rambles as you experienced today,
Dan, we'll put all the links in the show notes. People, if they can't get those, they'll find them there for you nice and easy. I didn't know about the fact you did the rights every day, so I'll be finding you on LinkedIn and on Facebook and doing that. I follow you on Twitter. I've got your books that I've got. I don't know if you can see it, because I've got the thing. I've got your books here and I'm always working for this, always at hand to me. So they are fantastic. So again, we'll put some links into those as well. Is there another book coming, Dan? I know these things take time and they're a labor of love, but is there anything on the horizon?
That's another podcast in and of itself. I need to seek psychological support myself on it. The last one, I wrote 4 in 4 years, and then I've had a hiatus since 2015, and I did sit down a few months ago to write the next one, but then I've done that about 10 times before. So as I said, I'm not really practicing what I preach very well there, but I'm probably now at a point where I am ready to get out what I want to get out, but I'm almost pleased I've had the 7 or 8 year gap, because in between I've had incredible Premier League experiences, England rugby experiences, golf. I forgot to mention earlier on lead psych for Aston Martin Formula One and stuff like that. So, you know, that those kind of experience very much lends themselves towards the kind of information you want to get across to people. So yeah, probably
we want the new book, Dan. We want the next one. So yeah, you got no pressure, but let's I'm looking forward to it. So get writing.
Brilliant.
And thanks so much for your time. Good to speak to you.
This episode was brought to you in association with our friends at Soccer Coach Weekly. Established since 2006, Soccer Coach Weekly is a leading source of inspiration and advice for all grassroots coaches. Join thousands of youth soccer coaches just like you, saving time and effort in their goal of having the most effective, enjoyable and successful coaching journey for them and their players. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the episode.